It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, how can we make sure those healthy-looking plants we bring home from the store don't turn into sad, lifeless eggplants in your home? A plant expert tells us how to create some indoor green space. First, do you have a $1 million idea for a new business? No? Ever thought of quitting your day-to-day job and turning a passion into a livelihood? Not every entrepreneur hits it big, but there are more than 30 million small businesses in the United States right now. And this group, our guest says, is leading a major shifting of gears in America's economic engine. In his new book, economics writer Adam Davidson digs into the new look of entrepreneurship, not in places like Silicon Valley, but in all walks of life. Adam is the co-founder of NPR's Planet Money podcast. He writes for The New Yorker, and his new book is The Passion Economy, The New Rules for Thriving in the 21st Century. Adam, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, when we hear about the economic transition we're in, Adam, a lot of times it's the bad news, the factories that are closed down, the people out of work, and that's a real part of the story. But you are finding bright spots out there that could be a lesson for the rest of us. What kind of things are you hunting for in this book?
Sure, and I do want to say at first that I don't discount right. all the bad. In fact, the bulk of my work at NPR's Planet Money, at The New Yorker, at the New York Times Magazine, has been covering some of the worst things about our economy, certainly the financial crisis, rising inequality, wage stagnation. These are bad, bad things that are very serious. But in that reporting, I would come across these bright spots, these interesting counter examples in which regular people are succeeding, not the 1% we hear so much about, not Silicon Valley billionaires or Wall Street titans, but regular folks in regular communities making very good but decent livings, not becoming wildly rich, applying some new rules. And it took a long time, but I eventually came to the conclusion that these are two sides of the same story, that we're in the middle of a massive shift in how our economy works. And like any massive shift, there are good things and bad things, and that understanding the logic of the new economy can free people to do some things that they probably couldn't have done in the 20th century in a very different mass production economy.
And you're talking about what you call the passion economy. And, you know, we've heard the advice to young people, follow your passion in the workplace or don't follow your passion. You're talking about something a little different, I think. Can you explain what you mean by the passion economy?
Sure. I define passion in the book as some set of things that you are uniquely able to do. This can be making a particular product, but could also just be sort of an approach to how to do work. So, you know, I think of myself. I was a reporter. I love explaining economic concepts to a broad lay audience. And so those are two different things, storytelling and economics. And I was able to put those together and develop a career. So it's not a lot of people assume I mean, oh, you're talking about crafting on Etsy or something. I mean, that can be, although I don't think that's always the best example. In the book, I have folks who do big industrial businesses, people work in agriculture, people who figure out a new way to be an accountant or a new way to be a lawyer. There's lots and lots of ways of finding your unique place in the economy and finding those people who most crave whatever it is you have to offer, as opposed to the 20th century, which was really mostly about being the same, copying what you are supposed to be doing, what your boss tells you, what your teachers tell you. I think sameness is over as a safe strategy in succeeding in this economy.
Talking to Adam Davidson about his new book, The Passion Economy, The New Rules for Thriving in the 21st Century. Adam, as you mentioned, you talk to individual people who make their own business, but I want to start with a story you have of an old school business that turned itself into something new, and I love it because it's a pencil company, and pencils are often used as that economic example of how capitalism helps us make products. Walk us through the story of a pencil company that made a big switch in the 21st century.
Yeah, this is about General Pencil, which is in New Jersey, in Jersey City. And it was probably the first company where I really was like, huh, I think there's something going on here. This is pretty interesting. So General Pencil, very old company, started in the original incarnation in the 1860s, still in the original family, the Weissenborn family. And mostly what they did is made sort of standard pencils, number two pencils, for the most part, for public schools in New Jersey and other states. And that was a really good way to make a living for pretty much the entire 20th century. They just, you know, there were more kids every year. They got bigger orders every year. They shipped those orders and that was that. And then a very familiar story, a story we've heard a million times. Chinese manufacturers started making pencils wildly cheaper, selling a gross of pencils, you know, 144 pencils for the price that General was charging for a dozen pencils. And at first they were able to hold on to some business because they had good long-term relationships with the local public schools. But over time, the public schools are like, look, we can't pay 12 times as much for your pencils. We're getting the cheap stuff from China. And they were pretty close to going out of business. Jim Weissenborn, who owned the company at the time, just all but gave up. And actually, it was his daughter, Katie, who said she would never be caught dead working in the pencil business, who came up with the insight that saved the company. She likes to sketch. She teaches classes. And she was in a store looking to buy some pencils for a drawing class. And she saw that there were very cheap number two pencils, and there were like $2 really fancy pencils for professional artists. But there's this huge space of like 80 to 90 cents, $1, $1.10 for a really good drawing pencil, but not a crazy expensive drawing pencil. And she thought, that's a space, sort of the high end of the low end or the low end of the high end. And that saved the company. They were able to create pencils and eventually pencil drawing kits where you'd get a bunch of pencils and some instructions on how to draw, sort of a perfect kid's birthday gift. But what they did is they're thriving now. They're doing wonderfully well. And what they did is so many of the lessons of what I think are in this economy. The old model, the 20th century model, is all about market share, volume, sell as many as you can to as many people as you can. And the new model is about focusing on, all right, what's our unique offering? You know, what do you do when you're the owner of a pencil company who loves drawing but isn't a fancy professional drawer? Well, she found something that she was uniquely able to create, and she was able to find that, yeah, there's a lot of people who wanted that thing. Maybe didn't even realize they wanted that thing until they went to a stationery store and saw a General pencil kit sitting there. But that is the lesson, I think. Don't do what people like you. Oh, I'm a lawyer, I'm going to do the things lawyers do. Or I'm a mechanic, I'm going to do the things that mechanics do. Do the thing only you can do that no one else is going to do. Although the key is then find the market, find the people who will actually pay you money for that
thing. Yeah, take that number two pencil now and connect those dots. How do we go from that unique talent and maybe passion that we have to then find where it's needed out there?
Yeah, and this is, I mean, I happen to have grown up in the art world. My dad's an actor and my mom runs dance companies. And I've known a lot of artists who follow their passion to create art, but don't make money at it. And that's a, you know, if you know, and struggle. People, I grew up with a lot of people who really didn't make a lot of money, but thrived emotionally, psychologically. They enjoyed doing their work. And that's a perfectly legitimate choice. But if you want to actually make a decent living, then there's the second step. It's not enough just to figure out what you love. The second step is, who in the world also values this thing that I create? And that's where I actually think there's really good news, that there's a lot of tools today, from just Google to far more advanced technologies and trade, that allow us to find those people, even if they're spread all over the globe, who most want the thing we want to give them.
We're talking to Adam Davidson, economics and business writer for The New Yorker, co-founder of NPR's Planet Money podcast, and himself an entrepreneur. We're talking about his new book. It's called The Passion Economy, about turning our special interests, abilities, and talents into a viable livelihood. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you left your day job to start a business based on a unique interest or skill that you have? How did it go? How is it going? Or have you helped reinvent an older business for the 21st century? Are you a small business person? What do you think of what you're hearing from Adam? Have you reinvented the way you do things, maybe breaking the mold and found success, or still trying to find that success? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our talk with Adam Davidson of The New Yorker. His new book is called The Passion Economy. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for our guest about how people can find a livelihood through something that they are passionate about? Do you have a story of starting a business, helping run a business, maybe reinventing it for changing times in the 21st century? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go to your calls now. Rita is with us in Spooner. Rita, hi. Rita, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi, go ahead, Rita.
I just wanted to make a comment to enforce the General Pencil Company. that they've expanded into areas where I'm a quilter and I use the General pencils for quilting. I use the charcoal pencils, the white ones and the light gray ones, and even some of the darker ones, because they wash out very easily from the fabric.
Well, and I want to find out, Rita, how did you discover these pencils that were going to be perfect for your quilting, just to see how this extended out from what Adam was talking about?
Well, my daughter was an artist, and I went to an art store to look for these General pencils, and then I found, because I was buying the darker ones for her to do her chalk pencils or her charcoal pencils, but then I found the lighter ones and the white ones, and I've been using them for at least 10 years, and they're awesome.
And I should ask, Rita, do you sell quilts? Or are you quilting as a hobby, a business, somewhere in between?
Quilting is a hobby. I don't think I would do it for a living, because I just enjoy it myself.
Fantastic. Rita, thank you so much. Adam, there's another end to your pencil story.
No, that's awesome. I love that. And I feel like I got to call Katie, who owns the company, and say, do you know about this quilting thing? You should market that.
That's fantastic.
I did want to mention quickly that, you know, the ideas of the book, I think, also do apply for people who have a job at a company.
Right.
It's not, you know, because there are ways of doing a job. And I think increasingly employers want this, reward this, that are new, that are different, that are unique. I do tend to profile entrepreneurs. Honestly, it's easier to write about them. It's kind of fun to write about them. But I think the lessons apply more broadly. And then, sorry, just the last thing I wanted to amplify is I do like the idea that some people, their deepest passion, they don't want to make a business. You know, I love photography. I take a lot of pictures. I don't want to make a business out of it. It's just fun for me. And that's a totally great way to be about some of your passions.
Rita, thanks so much for the call. We'll go to Mindy now in Lake Geneva. Mindy, hello.
Hey, thanks for taking the call.
What did you want to tell us about, Mindy?
Well, I left my day job to become a coach for female entrepreneurs to help them make more money. And I do that full time now.
And how did you make that transition? How did you make that leap?
Well, I got a couple clients first while I was still in my day job, and then just decided I was going to leap and the net would appear, and left in last summer, and just have been building the business from there.
Mindy, thank you so much for sharing that story. Adam, that reminds me of one of the stories you tell in your book about an accountant who kept being an accountant, but he kind of reinvented for himself what it meant to do that job. Can you share that story with us?
Yeah, absolutely. And I love hearing the story of someone being a mentor to
yeah.
women entrepreneurs. Jason Blummer, it's a story about Jason Blummer, an accountant in the Greenville area in South Carolina, who it sounds not unlike the previous caller, had a real desire to help people, to help people figure out how to transition into this very challenging economy. But he was an accountant, so what he spent his days doing was stuff that he himself found unbelievably boring, filing tax returns and audits and payroll, and he hated it. And he also felt like his customers didn't particularly love what he did. Who wants to do their taxes? Who says, boy, I would love 3 hours of an accountant's time? And so he just started asking, what would it be like if my customers loved me? What would it be like if people were delighted by the services I provide? And that was really how he started, a very simple but vague question, not one you would necessarily think would lead to a successful business. And it took him a long time to figure it out. But he eventually learned that there's a bunch of creative professionals out there, graphic designers, ad agencies, who are very good at being creative, don't understand business. And he happens to have a real strength at talking to those folks, helping them understand how to turn their passions, their creative passions, into a business. So he's become an accountant who's really more of like a tour guide to the new economy. He certainly helped me understand it a lot. In fact, I've hired him. He's now my accountant. And so so that would be an example of how, you know, he's somebody, like sometimes I get afraid that people think, oh, but I don't know what my passion is. That, you know, that first caller loves quilting or Adam loves photography. How do I know what my passion is? Most of us don't. It takes a while. It can take years to refine it, to figure it out. Sometimes it starts with just a niggling sense of disappointment and frustration with your current job. And, you know, rather than suppress that, I would say double down on it. Learn, you know, figure out what is it? Where does that come from? What can I do to, you know, what is my heart telling me, if I could say it? But then how do I make that into a business?
Thanks a lot for that call, Mindy, at 800-642-1234. Adam Davidson is with us from NPR's Planet Money. His new book is called The Passion Economy, The New Rules for Thriving in the 21st Century. Back to your calls. Tony is with us now in Glidden. Tony, hello.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I'd like to say that Adam is spot on with everything he's saying. Within the last 4 years, I stopped a career as a law enforcement officer after serving for over 9 years and started a business for myself to try and work for myself eventually. And everything he says is on. You have to put on all these different hats. You have to be an accountant. You have to be a maintenance man. You have to be everything. So you have to think about these things. Also, the customer service aspect is my biggest motto. And I found that just like Adam, becoming friendly with individuals is beneficial because they own businesses too, some of them, and they in turn help you out. You get return customers, you get your name out there. So I think I'm interested in looking into buying his book.
Tony, thanks a lot for that call. Adam, your thoughts on what Tony had to say about his business experience so far?
Yeah, no, I loved everything he said, and especially the part about buying my book, obviously. But I think that would be a perfect example of, you know, here's Tony in a job. You know, you don't think of law enforcement as, oh, that's an obvious the basis for an entrepreneurial career. But it sounds like he really paid close attention to the strengths he had, the ability to engage people, to develop that customer service mentality, and then apply it in a totally different way. And I think that is exactly what I love to hear and what many of the people in the book report. Sometimes the passion really is not about a particular product. I just told the story about Jason Blummer. Frankly, I bet he would have been a lot happier if he never was an accountant and he was doing the same kind of work, but in a different way. But his passion, like Tony's passion, was engaging with people and that was the passion. And it probably could have been applied in a whole host of different professions. So the passion doesn't necessarily mean, oh, I happen to love whatever it is, you know, quilting. It can be, I love being a leader of a team, or I love engaging people in a strong customer service way. You know, that there's lots of passions.
Thanks a lot for the call, Tony. Adam, I want to circle back to something you mentioned earlier, that this isn't just a philosophy for entrepreneurs, new startup businesses, but maybe established places. How can workplaces change to feed the passions of workers and make sure they don't want to go out and strike off their own because they're so frustrated?
Yeah, and there are a lot of companies that are getting this message, that are adjusting, and sadly a lot of companies that are not. And I think, you know, certainly if these are consumer facing companies, you know, the second you walk in, I mean, I don't want to beat up on any business, but when you walk in a Walmart, you know that this is not a place where the employees feel passion. But you walk into a Costco, a very similar type of business, and you can tell in a moment that the people here have more engagement. They feel more themselves here. Now, that doesn't mean they all have a passion for big box retailing, but they might have a passion for customer service. They might have a passion for organization. They might have all sorts of passions that Costco allows them by not having, you know, having rules, but not having such strict rules that nobody's able that people aren't able to express themselves. And I think what a lot of literature out there, academic literature and others, shows that one of the surest ways to improve sales, to improve productivity, is engaging your customers. We're already working people as much as we can, as many hours as we can. The extra oomph is when they're engaged. And the only way to get them engaged is connect to their passions.
It's a good place to leave it. Adam, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Really wonderful. Thank you so much.
That's Adam Davidson. He writes for The New Yorker, covering economics and business. He co-founded the NPR podcast Planet Money. He's CEO of a podcast production company. We talked to him today, though, about his new book. It's called The Passion Economy, The New Rules for Thriving in the 21st Century. There is still time for you to share your story if you've done some of the things that Adam is talking about, if you have started up your own business, or you're at a workplace that you feel does a good job of letting their workers be passionate about what they do. Share your story over at the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. If you've fallen into a cycle of buying healthy-looking houseplants only to have them die shortly afterward, then buying replacement houseplants only to have one of those die too, you're not alone. But our next guest says you are not doomed to houseplant failure. Tova Martin is a horticulturalist and author of many books about plants and gardening, including The Indestructible Houseplant and The Unexpected Houseplant. Tova, welcome to Central Time.
Hello.
Well, sometimes it seems to me like there are plant people who have those natural green thumbs, and then there's the rest of us. Is there hope for those of us who really just have trouble with our plants?
You know, I really say that there's no such thing as a brown thumb. it's all about caring and being sensitive and keeping an eye on, you know, what's going on. And you don't forget to feed your dog, do you?
Well, I don't have a dog. I think I would remember to feed. Our kids have made it this far, so that's a good
sign.
Yeah,
there you go. It's the same theory. So it's really all about keeping an eye on what's going on, but also it's about pairing the right plant with your environment. That's critical too.
Right. I wanted to ask you about that. How, before we get the plant in our house, how do we do our homework and make sure we've got the right plant for the place we live?
Well, hopefully people at garden centers might be able to help you. I have a book called The Indestructible Houseplant, another one called The Unexpected Houseplant that describe, you know, matching the right plant with the right place. It's something that you sort of have to study a little up front. There are many plants that do well in low light, and actually The Indestructible Houseplant is full of ideas like ferns and air plants and members of the bromeliad family and begonias and surprisingly even geraniums. You know, those wonderful plants that you see outside, they do great in a windowsill that's not so sunny. It's amazing what you can grow. You know, you don't have to just go for dentist office plants either. African violets do great.
Let's talk about watering. I think I've been in the position, I never have actually selected a houseplant for myself, but when caring for those of others in that position, oh, it's looking kind of wilty, I guess it's due for some water. I've waited too long then, haven't I?
You really have. I mean, it's like waiting for your teenager to faint before you feed them. It's not a good idea. Basically, you want to test the soil and see if it's, you know, if it's very dry or if it looks very dry, if it feels very dry, then, you know, that is a little bit, you know, you wait a little bit too long. You'll get a sense of it, really, but it does change with the weather.
We are talking about keeping our houseplants alive. Tova Martin is with us, author of books including The Unexpected Houseplant and The Indestructible Houseplant. All right, say we've mastered some of the basics. We've found a couple plants that we've managed to keep alive. They're indestructible in our household. Are there next level plants that once we've got the basics, we might branch out into?
You know what I love to do? I love to bring plants from the garden indoors. For example, low-light plants like heuchera and tiarella, and I've even grown hostas, to tell you the truth, indoors, primroses. All those plants are kind of make hellebores. They make great indoor plants, too, and they remind you of the garden. So that's a fun thing to do. A little bit of a challenge, if you want something that gives you a lot of bang for your buck, try growing a citrus. The Calamundin orange is the easiest citrus to grow. So that's a fun plant to grow, and an easy plant to grow. And there are ferns like the staghorn fern that's a little bit more challenging to grow. And all those are, kind of give you a lot of, sort of sense of, gee, I've succeeded.
Let's get back to some of our basics now. We've got a plant. We've done our homework. We've researched it. We've got it home. Do I need to repot it, say, after I get it in the door?
Well, I'm a big proponent of taking it out of that leprechaun green plastic pot and making it look beautiful. You know, the more beautiful it looks, the more you're probably going to like it and tend it and that sort of thing. So, and it'll thrive, and it's all cyclic. Everybody, everybody's happy. So what you want to do is you want to check out the roots when you take it out of that pot, that plastic pot, give it a beautiful container, check the roots and see if they're, if you can see them winding around, then you need to give it probably a slightly larger container.
Now,
but don't go crazy with that.
Now, we mentioned watering plants. I'm always scared to, again, when I'm caring for someone else's plants, I don't trust myself to buy them myself, but I worry about overwatering. How do we know if we're overwatering?
It's so interesting because I always think that there's some people that underwater and there's some people that overwater. They're just they work too hard on that plant. They cultivate it too much. So if a plant is, it's just like kind of sopping wet, you've overwatered it, that tends to get browning on the leaf edges. Unfortunately, that's also a sign of underwatering sometimes. So that's a little tricky. But you can usually, tell when you overwater a plant, basically you're suffocating it. The roots are not getting enough oxygen.
Apart from the water side of things, what are some other basics of plant maintenance around our house?
Well, plant maintenance, you want to groom them. You want to take off leaves that are dead. Anything that's dead is going to draw pests. So you don't want to, dead flowers, dead leaves, they've got to go. You want to prune it back. Too much growth, make it shapely so it's beautiful. Those are all important things. Check plants for pests occasionally, keep an eye on them. And that's about it. I don't suggest that you spritz them. That's not a good idea. If your house is very dry, in other words, if it lacks humidity, you're getting chapped licks and the cat is sending out sparks when you pet it. That will tell you that it's too dry in your house. You might want to run a humidifier.
I understand a lot of people, a new generation of people, are really getting into houseplants, people with maybe smaller apartments in big cities, that kind of thing, looking for that greenery. Are you seeing a houseplant renaissance out there?
Oh, absolutely. And it's such a good thing. Really, it's going to keep you happy and going over the winter. Winter is just far too long, especially in Wisconsin.
Oh, yeah.
And I think everyone would agree with that. And it just brings nature close by. I just don't know where I'd be without houseplants. And it seems like other people are discovering that also. It's like the cure.
Now, suppose I've got a plant. I'm expecting it to grow. It otherwise looks healthy. You know, it's got its leaves. They're sticking around. They're not falling off. They're not turning yellow or brown. But it's just kind of sitting there. When I thought it was going to expand to fill this pot I had, what am I doing wrong there, or am I doing anything wrong?
Depends on the plant, really. I mean, some plants are just tiny little morsels, and other plants are, will grow quickly, fill in a pot with foliage. It really depends on the plant. Don't judge yourself on the size of the plant. You know, sometimes little and adorable is wonderful, too.
Let's talk about mindset a little bit. This is coming back to kind of where we started. I saw an article you're quoted in, and I don't know if you're the one who actually said this, but think of that plant kind of like a pet. As you mentioned, you'd feed your dog. Tell us about a good plant mindset to make sure we don't neglect it.
Well, I think, just think nurture. I mean, that's the word that you might think of, but you don't really have to fuss over it. I think it's like any relationship. It's a give and take. If you're into it, it will, appreciate that, and it'll give you back beauty.
It's a good place to leave it. Tova, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Tova Martin is a horticulturalist and author of many books about plants and gardening, including The Indestructible Houseplant and The Unexpected Houseplant. She joined us to give us some tips on how to keep your houseplants alive and well. You can send us your pictures of your favorite houseplant. Hopefully it's doing well. Tweet it to us. Tweet us at Central Time WPR or email ideas@WPR.org. The White House unveiled its long-awaited Israeli-Palestinian peace plan this week. The plan, among many other things, includes allocating more land to Israel, while also including a call for a 4-year settlement freeze by Israel. It also includes a framework for an independent Palestinian state with several conditions for that to become a reality, including disarmament of the group Hamas. Here's President Trump talking about the plan at the White House yesterday with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
My vision presents a win-win opportunity for both sides. A realistic two-state solution that resolves the risk of Palestinian statehood to Israel's security. Today, Israel has taken a giant step toward peace. Yesterday, Prime Minister Netanyahu informed me that he is willing to endorse the vision as the basis for direct negotiations.
However, Palestinian leaders, including Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas, do not support the proposed plan, calling it a, quote, conspiracy deal, end quote. Our next guest joins to talk about the plan and the response so far. Nahal Tusi is foreign affairs correspondent at Politico. Nahal, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, we just touched on a couple of the basic parts of the deal. What are some of the other major proposals that the president and the Israeli leadership are making here?
Well, one key thing is basically that the plan envisions Israel gets control over the Jordan Valley, which effectively means that a Palestinian state, if it ever ends up existing, would be basically enclosed by Israel all around for the most part, with a couple of, exceptions like the Gaza Strip. And also that that Israel would get to control a bunch of major settlements that already exist inside the West Bank. And what's really striking about that is that effectively the Israeli prime minister said that he's going to go ahead and apply or move to apply Israeli law to those areas that he sees that the president of the United States has effectively said is going to be part of a future state of the future Israel. And so that basically means that Israel is annexing the West Bank settlements as well as the Jordan Valley, even before the Palestinians are given their own state. And that is, you know, and they're going to have a vote on it in the Israeli cabinet this Sunday. And it's interesting because the Israelis are trying to make a distinction. They're basically saying, look, we're just going to be applying Israeli law. That's what we're going to be voting on. It's not annexation. But for the international community, that's really a distinction without a difference. It's effectively the same thing. And, you know, other pieces, I mean, it's a very detailed plan. I was really struck by how detailed it was. But some of the stuff in it just seems kind of unlikely. For instance, the idea that Hamas is going to have to disarm. I just don't know how the Palestinian leadership in the West Bank is ever going to make that happen.
Now, a key thing here, were the Palestinians at all involved in drafting or negotiating the plan released this week?
No. In the beginning, when the Trump administration started pursuing this idea, there was some outreach to the Palestinians. But then Trump started making moves that were just so, so pro-Israel. I mean, he was siding with Israel on virtually everything. And the Palestinians pretty quickly realized that, or they decided that this was just not going to work, that they're better off ignoring this administration. Now, that's their point of view. And basically, when President Trump decided to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel and move the U.S. embassy there, that was the last straw. So the Palestinians have cut off contact ever since. Now, look, it's possible that, like, via classified channels or something, there's some you know, way to reach them for whatever extreme reason you might need to. But in terms of, like, getting Palestinian input for this plan or anything like that, no, pretty much no. And the way that the Trump administration has kind of approached this is, look, this is a take it or leave it thing. This isn't, like, you know, a starting point for negotiations. This is the deal. And the Palestinians just don't understand why they would have to give into that after 70 years of conflict. And not just only that, but, you know, they just feel like their concerns are not being listened to in any way at all. And it's really extraordinary. On the other hand, you know, the Trump administration has made some decisions that are going to be hard to reverse and that some future administrations may not want to reverse. Like the embassy and the Jerusalem thing, I don't think any president, the U.S. president in the future, is going to reverse those moves. But another thing that the Trump administration did is they're trying to redefine what it means to be a Palestinian refugee. Basically, they're saying descendants of the original Palestinian refugees cannot be considered refugees anymore. And so that is aimed at basically very much limiting the number of people who would in the future be able to claim the right to return to that territory. And that's something that, you know, I know that a lot of, you know, Democrats are saying that that's unfair. That's something that the two parties should decide, et cetera. And of course, the Palestinians are rejecting it. But I wouldn't be surprised if in the future you saw U.S. administration stick to that because they just view the idea of millions and millions of Palestinians in the diaspora around the world going back as something untenable for Israel.
Talking to Nahal Tusi from Politico, looking at the proposal released by the Trump administration this week on Israel and Palestine. Want to give a listen to President Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, serving as a senior advisor in the White House, heavily involved in drafting this plan. Here he is on CNN defending the proposal.
What you've seen today is that President Trump's built a lot of trust with the state of Israel. He's done a lot of great things that have made Israel more secure and the relationship between America and Israel stronger. And what he's been able to do today is deliver for the Palestinians a pathway to a state, a contiguous territory, and conditions where they can earn their way to their independence, their dignity, all these different things, along with a $50 billion economic plan that could make them a very, very thriving state in the future. So it's a big opportunity for the Palestinians. And, you know, they have a perfect track record of blowing every opportunity they've had in their past. But perhaps maybe their leadership will read the details of it, stop posturing, and do what's best to try to make the Palestinian people's lives better.
Let's touch on a couple of those points there. What is the pathway to a state for Palestinians under this proposal?
Well, they basically have to accept, for instance, the idea that Israel is going to control security in this future Palestinian state for effectively ever, although the idea is that over time, you know, that Israel is would cede control of security. And that's just, I mean, I just don't think that's realistic. And so that's something, you know, they're effectively a demilitarized, landlocked state for the most part, except Gaza, with a bunch of like West Bank settlements within them that are controlled by Israel, and which Israel controls the security around them and inside them. So look, what people, what the Palestinians are thinking now increasingly is this is basically a one state solution that this administration has come up with. It's effectively one state, but it's an apartheid state because you have two groups of people and one group does not have equal rights and is living, in their view, under a sense of occupation. And honestly, I wouldn't be surprised if this basically fuels a more rights-based movement among the Palestinians, basically with the idea that, fine, we'll live in one state, but we get to have equal rights as citizens. And that basically raises questions about the future identity of Israel. Will it remain a Jewish majority country? Can it stay democratic and retain that identity? These are big questions, but I think basically what this plan has is trying to do or does is kill the two-state solution.
And is the Palestinian negotiating position weakened because they're not seeing as much support from Muslim countries, Arab countries, especially in the Middle East, that they used to be able to count on?
It is weakened, absolutely, because a lot of these Arab countries, in particular heavyweights like Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, their bigger concern now is Iran. And they have been willing to coordinate with the Americans, with the Israelis and others on finding a way to push back Iran, even if it means staying quiet or downplaying the Palestinian cause. And so, yeah, it's very different now than it was even a few years ago, really.
We've seen an initial, as you were saying, a negative reaction from Palestinian leaders on this. What are you watching for now that this plan is out there?
Well, the question is, how will some of these parties respond? I mean, is Hamas going to, this is the militant group that controls the Gaza Strip, are they going to try to carry out some sort of violence in response to this? Will the Palestinians see if there's a way to shore up support among the Arab countries again, but also maybe with non-Arab countries that have come to side with them to a degree, such as Turkey, such as Iran? I think a big point also is that one of the real striking things about this is that basically the Trump administration was betting on the idea that if they promised the Palestinians billions of dollars in economic assistance, which, by the way, would not come from the United States for the most part, they were hoping Arab countries would step up for that, that the Palestinians would just go for that, even if it meant giving up their political rights. And I don't know if that's something that could, down the line, if you have a particularly even more impoverished Palestinian community, even more desperate one, if that's something that will bring people to the table or not. My guess is no. But I do think that this idea of like, look, we will help improve your status, your economic status, but you have to forego these political rights you want. I wouldn't be surprised if the Trump administration at least keeps wishing that. And I think one important question is whether Trump will be reelected, and if he is, how much he and Kushner and others push this plan, or whether it just gathers dust on some shelf.
Nahal, thanks a lot for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Nahal Tusi, foreign affairs correspondent for Politico. She joined us today to talk about the White House's proposed Israeli-Palestinian peace plan that was released this week, largely orchestrated by the president's son-in-law and senior advisor, Jared Kushner, receiving mixed reviews, big support from the prime minister of Israel, not support, though, from Palestinian leadership so far. A lot to watch out for in the coming weeks. The Super Bowl is coming up this weekend. That means some people will be betting on it, sometimes on the game's outcome, but there are a lot of weird side bets. We're not encouraging gambling now, but you can play along with some of these without risking your money online and elsewhere. Bill Martins, a Central producer, is here. Hey, Bill, what are we seeing for a weird side bets or guesses when it comes to the Super Bowl?
Okay, there are a whole bunch of them. I'm going to give you three of them here real quick. So you can bet on the coin toss. 50-50, right? Heads or tails. There's one online betting agency, whatever you want to call it, that's saying so far 56% are going with heads.
Wow.
So smart money is on heads, I guess.
Okay. Because they're considering things like wind direction anticipated. And,
right, exactly.
The weight of the coin.
Right. You can also bet on the Gatorade shower color. So each year, you know, the winning coach gets doused with Gatorade. So
yeah.
Red is the favorite. Purple is the big underdog. You can also bet on some other colors or none.
Wow.
Maybe there won't be a Gatorade shower, so you can bet on that. And also, who will the most valuable player thank first? So teammates is the favorite. The owner is the underdog. You can also bet on God, the coach, and the family, or doesn't thank anybody.
Wow. Now, I saw on CBS Sports, they have some how long will it take for Demi Lovato to sing the national anthem.
Right.
They have a little quiz online you can do without betting money at all.
Oh, wow.
That's pretty cool.
And the over-under for that is like 2 minutes, I believe. You can also bet on how long she's going to sing Brave, as in Home of the Brave at the end.
How long do you hold that?
Yeah. I don't know.
Wow. It's just a whole bunch of random number generators.
Who cares about the game?
Right. All right, I'm putting my money on the table. No, I'm not. Bill, thanks. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.